Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Market Music with Fairbairn and Russell.
Welcome back to the Market Musings podcast with Fairbairn and Russell. And today we welcome Alan Green. And if you are a regular listener to the Stockbox programme Research Talks, you will know who Alan Green is. But effectively, Alan Green is a research analyst, and he comes on every week onto the Stockbox Research Talks and presents an investment case. And we're very pleased to welcome him on the more casual have a drink down the pub, although it's a bit early in the morning for that right now, to learn a little bit. Never too early for the man in Scotland, no. But we're very pleased, Alan, to welcome you to learn a little bit more about you and your background and what you like about investing. So welcome.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen, and I'll raise a virtual glass to you both as it's Friday. And in fact, I'm rather fond of Weiss beer at the moment. Tesco have a great offer on Weiss beer, so I've been going down, sweeping the shelves and loading up my fridge in the garage, so I can just pop out and have the odd Weiss beer. So
it's nice. I like that as well. I like Weiss beer. Yeah.
Unfortunately, in Scotland, we don't get any booze bargains because, let's just say, our government has put the minimum pricing on alcohol, so it's nowhere near as cheap what it is in England, which is a bit frustrating for a heavy tenants drinker. Used to be 50 pence a can you could get it for in the multi packs, and now it's about 75, 80, 90 pence a can. Mm. Shocking, but such is life.
So, Kenny, could you not, like we used to do here, we jump on the cross-channel ferry or the tunnel and go over and shop for a day? Is it feasible that you could pop over?
Well, I'm probably about 2 hours from the border, but my son is now in the Navy and he's down in Portsmouth and he's due to come up, I think, next week for his summer leave.
Excellent.
So I think I'll be asking him to...
make a stop.
To load up his... Yeah, but the problem is he's got an Audi TT Quattro, so there's not a lot of room in it, and he's usually given a couple of people lifts as well. So I don't know. We'll see if I can squeeze in maybe 30 cans or 40 cans or something.
Excellent.
Good stuff. Yeah, no, it's great to have you at the podcast, Alan. Obviously, you spoke at length with Mark and Stockbox, but we thought it was time to get you on here and see who the real Alan is. As you probably know, we like to sort of dig into your past and, you know, see what you've done in life. You know, have you always been involved in investment and mining, or has there been a couple of career changes along the way? I mean, there certainly has been for me.
So, oh my goodness me, yeah, me too, very much so, Kenny. And well, in fact, where I live now in Seaford, I originally started out, I worked in the police force. I was a police officer, and I still have some mates in the force who I go touring Europe with on motorbikes when of course, we're not in lockdown. But no, I was in advertising for many years, and then I got into investing, I suppose, late 90s, started investing in small cap companies. And then I bumped into a guy called Malcolm Stacey. And Malcolm was a BBC journalist. He produced and producer, worked on You and Yours on Radio 4 and various other shows. And Malcolm was also an author and still is an author. And he works now for He does the odd bit of work for a shirt tipping website, which I shan't name here. So Malcolm, I asked Malcolm if he'd be happy to write a few columns and for the website that I started up, which was called Share Crazy. And I think at the time when I was digging around doing some research, I found a lot of the online resources were pretty boring and staid. So I thought, well, how about if we just design something with which looks a bit more current, I suppose, contemporary, and bring in a marketing character. So we designed this character called Joe Public, who was basically a marketing device. So we go to investing shows and we take a stand, and then we'd have this huge character walking around scaring the living daylights out of old people, handing out pens and so on. But it was very effective. So Malcolm came and wrote a column for that website, and sold that on in 2007 to a fund management group. And really, that sort of put me on the path I'm on today, which is investing. And we provide PR and IR services for various companies listed on AIM, also some pre-IPO companies, and that really brings us up to date in terms of my career cycle.
All right, it's quite interesting you talk about the police, because I actually failed the medical to get into the police. I'm going back 1992 would be, I think, maybe 93. Okay.
Yep.
And it was quite a strange experience, because I don't know what it was like down in England, but I remember going for the initial aptitude test, if you want to call it that. And I think it's a bit different today. It's a bit easier, I think, today. In those days, it was quite intense. It was almost like sitting when you're sort of hires or your A levels again. And I remember it was probably, let's say there was 80 guys and girls in the room, and I don't know what rank the guy was, but he was basically saying, right, out of you 80 people, one person will make it through. And you're kind of thinking, nah, that's ridiculous.
Good.
But he was right, you know. I mean, I probably get through to the I got to the medical, so I was almost in. But I failed the medical, and that was the end of that. But it was something I was prepared to get into at a young age. And I'm kind of glad in a way that I didn't get in. You know, things have worked out all right for me, but it was an interesting process and quite intense, and it would be interesting to see what it's like today, because I don't think it's as difficult to get into the police as it used to be back in the day.
No, well, I still have many friends in the force, and in fact, just now, we'll go bike touring, and there's a retired police sergeant, there's a former Met pursuit rider, and a guy who's a copper in Brighton, and ride out with these guys. So the humour and the banter is still there, which is great fun. But certainly when I joined, Kenny, I actually joined the cadets straight from school. So I was in the police cadets, and mm-hmm. really, if you get through the police cadets and do okay there, it's you're almost guaranteed entry. And certainly the crowd I joined with at the time, all of us got through, and we were accepted in. So it was pretty straightforward. But yeah, I think I soon realised that it wasn't for me, and so I stayed for a couple of years and moved on. But still really enjoyed the time and made some great friends, which I still have today. So there's a lot to be said for it.
What did you do in the police then, Alan? Was it riding?
No, not at all. I went in. Of course, you go through your initial probationary period, which is 2 years. So I got to the end of my 2 years and decided that that was it.
Oh, okay.
But of course the benefits are great. You know, if it's the job for you, you get very well looked after. There's a great pension scheme. So many other benefits. But you've got to have an aptitude and be cut out for it. And I think I could see, you know, my friends, the guys I grew up with were off doing different things, and I was keen to get out into the big bad world and expand my horizons, which I have.
Yeah, yeah. Well, My dad actually spent about 15 years in the police, so he did, and he was based in the Gorbals. And for you guys that don't know the Gorbals in Glasgow in the 60s and early 70s, it was quite a different place than it is today, shall we say. So no, I had a few interesting stories from him.
Yeah.
But yeah. No, he was the same. After about 15 years, he was like, nah, I can't anymore. So he moved on as well. But no, it's interesting how many different careers that you have in your life, or you attempt to have in your life before you sort of finally, well, I'm not saying I'm settled just now, but I'm certainly settled for the time being. But I'm getting older, so I don't want to be doing any more career changes. It gets harder and harder each time, so it does. It's not an easy thing to do. You're fortunate, Mark. You've done the same thing since you left school, haven't you? Pretty much.
Yeah, basically, yeah. Well, or university, you could say. Yeah, at the moment, I haven't. No, I haven't. Yeah.
Oh, well, we'll do a podcast with you then, because your background won't last that long.
No, I came out of university at 23 when I worked with my dad in a training company doing multimedia. And I still do that today. Well, and not with him, but you know, still do the same kind of work. So yeah, it's probably not that interesting. I mean, I did have a stint in the Royal Navy Reserve.
Yes, you told me about that. Yeah. I mean, the days have changed now. I mean, obviously, I imagine, Alan, you're of a similar age to me. I mean, it used to be that your parents would have the same career for, like, you know, 40 years. You know, they would just have that one job. They all went down the mine, or they went and worked in the local factory or whatever. But now everybody seems to be job hopping and chasing the next big payday.
Yeah, absolutely. My dad was an engineer in a factory, and then he had a career change midlife and became a school teacher, and that's it. He was there till he retired. So, I mean, he had the one change. My mother, on the other hand, was a nurse all the way through. Until she retired. So, you're right. I think you made your career choice back in those days, and you stuck with it. You know, it was through thick and thin, and you battled through. But I think today's society, you know, there are so many opportunities on offer, and I think the opportunity now to work virtually and create something almost out of nothing is the opportunities and chances have never been so good. We're seeing a lot of innovation come about through people starting up businesses in the back bedroom, or just starting an app or an idea online, and that's really exciting. And I think as investors, you know, we're across this in the market all the time, and seeing these new ideas, and literally, if something's right for the market, it can, you know, from start to finish, it could be as little as 6 months, and something that started as the germ of an idea in June actually becomes a major market player by Christmas. You know, and that I find really exciting about today's society.
Yeah, definitely. Technology changes all the time, so it does. It makes a lot of these projects accelerate at a rapid pace. I just want to step back. I can actually remember, when you talked about share crazy, I can actually remember that back in the day. Again, that's an age thing. But obviously, you moved on from Share Talk, and you've now got a company called Brand Communications and Brand UK. Can you explain a bit about how that came about, Alan?
So, certainly, yeah. Brand UK Limited, Brand Communications, really started out as my earnings vehicle, because when I sold Share Crazy, I had something like a 15-month earnout. So I just set the company up to create a tax-efficient vehicle for me to earn through. And then as I came to the end of that, we were approached by, we built up, obviously, a big database through our work with Share Crazy, and we were known with a community of retail investors. So we used that to springboard into working for brokers, and we provided brokers with a one-stop marketing shop where we'd provide bespoke marketing reports, and we'd disseminate the content out to our financial media network, and also a network of journalists that we built up over the period that we still have today. So that evolved, and then I think probably around 2012, 2013, we started working with some listed companies. Started working, that was our first company, Advanced Oncotherapy, actually. We started working with them, AVO. And then it just snowballed from there. And we've been working, oh, goodness, we've had many, many companies on our books since then. And some we've just done bespoke one-off projects for, and others we've just provided an ongoing service. And indeed, some of them we've been working with for 6-7 years non-stop. So yeah, you know, it's we're obviously doing something right.
Yeah, definitely. And you still enjoy the day-to-day stuff? And
yeah, I love it. I and I think because of the freedom that one has with being able to work online and provide a service online, it's very good. But also particularly in the financial services industry, integrity is everything, and longevity is everything too. So yeah, it's very hard. Some people can go in and make an impact, but that tends to be the exception rather than the norm. If you're building a long term offering in this sector, you know, people are investing money. They've got to be able to trust your judgment, trust what you say, and also, you know, realize that we're all fallible human beings. You know, we do make mistakes sometimes, so we don't get it right all the time. But I think I think if you can be transparent in the way you work and just be consistent with your offering, then you will build something of value.
Yeah, I suppose that's. I mean, we started out Fairbairn and Russell. I think was it end of February? Was it Mark?
Yeah, it was early in the year, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it was early in the year, and I think the first podcast, I was probably backed into a corner to do it. I didn't really want to do it, to be honest, because I didn't feel comfortable with it. And sometimes I still don't feel comfortable with podcasts because I'm out of my comfort zone. But usually I've got a beer in my hand, which helps. But as you say, it's too early.
It's never too early.
I'm not saying we don't really know where we're going with this. It just seems to keep evolving. And originally it was supposed to be the sort of mining sector, or, you know, maybe a bit of tech as well. But we've started interviewing all sorts of people from all over the world. So
Originally it was me and you, wasn't it, talking about more musing on the markets, really, just us. But then people started to ask to come on, and then we got directors, and we found that's probably more interesting, actually, to get guests on and talk to them. And then the markets come out naturally anyway. So, yeah, it has evolved.
But, now, you guys have certainly blazed a trail since starting. So, you're going back to what I said earlier, I think you are the exception rather than the rule. But it is hard to sort of, you know, come in and make waves in this market. But I think you've done that just through your informal approach. And I think people like listening to, you know, guys having a chat down the pub, which we almost are. That's how it comes across. And indeed, back in Share Crazy days, Malcolm Stacey, and in fact, he still refers to it today. He used to call. He'd be working from a virtual pub called the Punter's Return, and you know, that still resonates today, which it's a great idea. But yeah, I think if listeners can feel their standing at the bar with us and having a chat, then that's good. It's a great way to exchange information. And let's not forget, really, that's how the city's worked for so many years. Doesn't work actually in the offices. It's about those lunches, and it's about just popping down to the Grapes and having a beer with somebody and striking a multi-million pound deal.
The Punter's Return, that's a great name.
It is, isn't it?
I remember my friend who's very driven to do random things. He's diverting off for a minute here, but he built a pub in his garage when we were at university, just after university, and he didn't do it by halves. I remember we went shopping and we got old arcade machines and like pinball machines and like lino, and really transformed this garage into a pub with a bar, and he called it the Otter's Pocket. And we were regulars down the Otter's Pocket.
But that's a great idea. And equally, during the coronavirus, in fact, Gav, one of the guys that we ride with, he was the copper in Brighton, one of his friends built a bar called the Corona Bar in their back garden. And literally built a shed and, you know, huge great speakers either side of the bar, and you know, all of the optics and everything else. Yeah, great. You know, that's
I've not got the bar in the garage, but I've got the darts hockey. So been in there quite a lot. Unfortunately, the kids are getting a bit older now and they don't play as much darts as we used to, but yeah, it's still quite good to get in there and just escape for half an hour and try and hit 180s. I'm not very good at it. I can occasionally hit them, but not as good as I used to be. But just moving on to, obviously, there's a big passion in your life, Alan, motorbikes. It's pretty evident from your Twitter feed. How did that start? Has that always been part of your life, or is it I'm not going to say a midlife crisis, but you know what I mean? Sometimes you pick up these kind of, petrol head on motorbikes, or, you know, it could be anything, you know, so mid-40s or something.
Well, I've been having a midlife crisis since my mid-teens, so but certainly it's been a lifelong passion. I started racing around on these sports mopeds called Fizzies back in the
I said this last time, didn't I? I said this, I will let you know what the bike my dad has in his garage, and it was a Fizzy. Yes.
He's got the same.
He's got one. Unfortunately, you'll probably weep if you saw it, because it's not been abandoned. You know, it's been in the garage for years, but it's not been ridden for a long time. And it does need a lot of work. And I remember my brother, who's now in the Navy, when he was maybe 16 or something, him and my dad tried to really rejuvenate this Fizzy so he could have it as his bike. And they tried and tried and tried and did lots of different things to it. And they did just about get it working, but it was never perfect. Mm. And my brother used to commute to it to college. And one afternoon he was coming back and something went wrong. I think maybe the chain snapped or something, and he had to walk probably about 8 or 10 miles with pushing this bike along a dual carriage on the side of a dual carriageway. And he got home and he said, "I'm never doing that again." And that was it. He then went and bought his own bike. And since then, unfortunately, the Fizzy is back to sitting in the garage doing nothing. But people come round, and you know, someone like you would come round. Oh wow, I'd love to take that on. And my dad wants someone to fix it, but I think it's very difficult to get an enthusiast like yourself or someone else to do it up and then just give it back to my dad to mess around on. You know, because you're going to want to ride it yourself, aren't you? If you've done the work on it. But I don't know. Maybe one day he'll do it. But he still works full time, my dad, and I don't know if that's going to stop anytime soon. but yeah.
That's really interesting, Mark. I mean, the thing is, the Fizzies were iconic, and it was a great thing for freedom for guys and girls in the late teens just to get out and be riding what felt like a real motorcycle. And they're incredibly simple. The motor is very simple, but I'm sort of referring to motorcycles now as potential investments as well, because really the bikes of that era onwards, they're bikes today that are still very practical, can keep up with modern traffic speeds and everything else. But they're gaining value at the same time. And your dad's Fizzy now, I mean, Conker's Fizzies are selling for £7,500-£8,000.
Mm. Yeah.
As opposed to a couple of hundred quid, that they'd have cost in the first place. But I think what's appealed to me, I mean, throughout the years, I've done various things. I used to race at club level, race at Brands Hatch, Cabwell Park, circuits all around the country, and fallen off at a few too, I might add. But that's still here to tell the tale. And just the whole scene is incredibly engaging, and certainly the touring that I now do as much of as I can when I'm not working. Somebody once said that if you drive a beautiful road in a car, you go from A to B. It's like watching a movie. And the same person then said it, but if you do it on a motorcycle, you're actually in the movie. And that really, I think, sums up just what bikes are like for those that love it. Last year, for instance, five of us rode down to Austria, and we we took about a week, just over a week, and just rode through the passes. We went to Birch's Garden, the Eagle's Nest, where, you know, of course, Hitler used to live years ago, which is a fantastic place to visit if you get a chance. And then, of course, you sample the hostelry. And I mentioned right at the start my fondness for Weiss beer, and of course, that's it's an abundance over there. But certainly. A lot of the bikes from the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s now make very practical forms of transport, but also investments too. And there's a chap that I follow, and in fact saw at an investing show in London a few years ago, a guy called Paul Jaston, and he's put together. He provides classic bikes for clients, and he'll put together a specification that the bike has to be investment grade in order to fetch the incredible sums of money that some of them do. The other attraction, of course, with bikes is storage. As opposed to classic cars, which of course take up a huge amount of space, you can get as many as six bikes into the same space that a car would take up. So many people have, you know, such as your dad, Mark, have a single bike in the garage. And if you've got something of that era, then it's worth having a look at it. There's a very good website called howmanyleft.co.uk. And to give you some idea of the availability or the how many bikes are actually left on the road, you can go to this, put in the specification of the bike, and it'll tell you how many bikes of that particular ilk are actually left in the UK. Okay. We can also see the value or the popularity of these bikes as well through a lot of the racing events. There are, as well as racing events, there are rallies up and down the country. We now have, in the middle of the summer, when of course COVID isn't playing a part, we have the classic TT on the Isle of Man, where well-known racers go and race old classic bikes around. And Barry Sheen's bike, of course, is still used regularly there on the circuit. But there's been a real surge in prices over the past 10 years. And I'm going to just quote a couple of examples to you. as well as the traditional racing bikes, which are worth an awful lot of money. I mean, and when I say racing bikes, I'm talking pre-MotoGP. So anyone that watches biking today will probably have heard of Valentino Rossi, who's the big star in MotoGP. But in the 90s, you had two-stroke racing bikes, and of course, two-stroke bikes have been largely phased out now because they're unclean because they burn oil in their induction or combustion cycle. But you had guys like Kevin Schwantz, Mick Doohan, Wayne Rainey, and other famous racers that used to race these things. And some of these bikes now can be picked up with the history for just over £100,000, and can then be used, can then be ridden at events, and then just kept and kept in running order. And some of these bikes are reaching incredible amounts of money when they go back to auction. If we go back earlier, there are some very famous British bikes, and probably the most iconic bike of all time in the UK is the Vincent Black Shadow, which is a V-twin produced by a company. I believe they were up near Stevenage. That was the manufacturing plant. Famous all over the world for the quality of their engineering. The bikes were 1,000cc V-twins. Many of these really valuable bikes go through auctions with Bonhams and so on. And probably the most recent record a sale for an auction, a Vincent Black Lightning 1951 that was raced. It was called Gunga Din. It set the Australian land speed record in 1951 or 52, I think it was, of 141 miles an hour, which is not a huge amount by today's standards. But this bike sold for £711,848 2 years ago. And that's just one example. Some of the race bikes will go for an awful lot more than that. But if we bring it back down to more practical everyday levels, a lot of the late 70s and 80s Japanese superbikes, which are still very practical today, have really started to rise in value. I have a CBX1000, which is a 1979 motorcycle. It's a six-cylinder bike, and it was rare in its day because Honda, I think it was probably as much to do with corporate dick swing as anything else. I hope I can say that on the podcast. But Honda wanted to prove to the other manufacturers that they were technically ahead of them, so they brought out this incredible-looking motor. And it's still very valuable today. But these bikes are selling probably secondhand for £5,000, £6,000 in 2010. They're selling for £30,000, £35,000, £40,000 now. And again, there are something like 100 on the road in the UK. And, of course, there are bikes around the world. But the bikes that are ready for restoration are fewer and further between because people have realized the inherent value in these things. And, of course, they're buying them and restoring them. And, of course, if you're a private owner, you can buy something like this, invest into it, and then just ride it, enjoy it, and sit on it. And it doesn't incur any capital gains tax if you sell it on. You know, if you sell the bike privately, it's viewed as a wasting chattel by the Inland Revenue. So, in the same way you're dealt with his fizzy in the garage, Mark, you know, if you get that running, look after it. It doesn't need to be conquerors condition, but make sure it's original. Another 10 years' time, you could have a nice little investment on your hands there.
So do you restore them yourself then, Alan?
Yes, the case of the CBX, I did a lot of the cycle work, but the actual motor is so complex. It's a six-cylinder bike, double overhead camshaft, 24 valves. So, and it also has six carburetors, so they're very difficult to set up. So I had somebody restore the engine, and this guy is an aero engineer, so I know it's been done properly. But the rest of the bikes, I've rebuilt. I have a Honda 500 in the garage too. That I rebuilt that motor, and we got it running with some difficulty. And I've had a number of Suzukis over the years too, which I've restored and sold on. So I'm happy to do the work up to a certain level, and I'm also happy to do rattle can spray jobs as well to get the bike back to the original color. So yeah, it's a passion. I mean, you know, Kenny will go into the garage and play darts. I'll go into the garage and have a bike on the ramp, get my socket set out, and I'll probably reach into the fridge, grab a Weiss beer, and then switch the radio on.
the darts is just a front for drinking. So there's no other reason. It's the same way I like cooking as well. That's just another front for drinking earlier in the day. So it is. But no, it was interesting you're talking about racing bikes because we quite often, not so much now because the kids are older, but we used to go to Knock Hill all the time for the touring cars and the hot hatches and then the classic days. And we always used to keep saying, we need to go and see the bikes. And we've just never done it. I don't know if you've raced Knock Hill yourself. I mean, it's a ridiculously tight circuit, and it's got its own climate. You know, it's a unique climate.
I've seen racing from Knock Hill many times. I've not actually been there. I've not actually raced there, Kenny. The furthest north I've come is Alton Park, Mallory Park, and Cabell Park. So, the rest of the circuit is called Snetterton, Pembrey in Wales, Thruxton, Brands Hatch, and of course Lydon here in Kent as well. But
We've actually got a picture. I mean, it's to describe Knock Hill for our listeners, you know, it sits up in the top of a hill. And I remember, I think it was May the 1st, they have a kind of an open day every year. And we were up there, and I think there's a picture of us, shorts and T-shirt, sitting in chairs watching whatever was going on in front of us. And an hour later, it was a blizzard. You know, that's the kind of... you know, four seasons in one day, definitely. And all it does is just makes the racing more interesting because some of the crashes you've seen up there are just fantastic. And in fact, one day they had Rubens Barrichello's Formula One car at the time.
Yeah.
And they were racing that round there. And actually, there was a bike that day as well. So they were doing time trials with a bike against the Formula One car. And it was just scary how fast that they could put this Formula One car round this really, really tight circuit. I think they took, I'm going to say 16, 17 seconds off the lap record. It was just, it was great. The noise as well is just, it echoes off the hills all round about. It was brilliant. A great day out, so it was.
They're incredible. The Formula One cars, certainly the earlier ones, the V10s and the V12s, just sound astonishing, don't they? And they, as you say, you know, compared to anything else, you know, bikes, touring cars, anything else, a Formula One car can just, as you say, knock about 17 seconds off the lap record. It's incredible to watch. It really is.
Yeah, good stuff. All right, well, we've maybe spoken enough about bikes and petrol heads and cars, etc. We'll move back on to investments, if that's all right, to finish up with, Alan. Just obviously, you speak weekly with Mark about a couple of investments that are hot or that look interesting. Is there anything on your radar that you're looking at just now or you currently hold that's worth a mention?
Yes, indeed. There are. Well, I do have a focus on small cap mining stocks at the moment, and I talked in separately with Mark about Cadence Minerals, and they're a mining investment company. They have a range of investments in companies around the world, in the Sinovec lithium project through European Metals Holdings, MacArthur Minerals iron ore in Australia, and a number of lithium investments. But they're also about to acquire the Amapa iron ore project in Brazil, which is a former Anglo-American iron ore mine. And it's the company's just had an incredibly exciting juncture. There's been quite a bit of price movement this week. We've seen the share price advance rapidly, and but I still think it's materially undervalued. I hold shares in the company, and I'm just really excited for where this is going to go, because we hear the term ten bagger banded around quite frequently, but I genuinely believe Cadence could be one such company, and also ECR Minerals, which is another company. It has a number of gold mining projects. The two key projects it owns 100% are in Victoria and Australia, which of course is affected by the COVID lockdown at the moment. But a lot of work undertaken both at Creswick and Bayliston projects, and the company have had interest from a number of farming partners, and indeed site visits are planned for these potential partners to come and look at the prospects. Creswick, in fact, sampling was undertaken last year, and they were pulling gold nuggets out of the bags that they were sampling. So it just bodes very well for what's a very exciting time for the company. Other investments I hold, I have a number of funds. I have the Fidelity Technology Fund, which has done very well and continues to drive forward. I had the Baillie Gifford Global Discovery Fund, which has also powered ahead over the times that there's exposure to Far Eastern markets with those companies. And also just as the lockdown started, or just as the crisis really hit the markets, I sold out of my FTSE 100 stocks and then bought back in lower down. And I'm still a big holder of Shell, Rio Tinto, Astra. I hold as well. That's a very good stock, and I'm just trying to maintain some income, some exposure to growth, I've also, for the first time in a number of years, started to move back into the banks. I bought some Barclays. And also into the insurers as well, bought some Legal and General. So it's I think the markets we're seeing at the moment this battle between good news and bad news, and the markets are moving quite dramatically into intraday, creating some great trading opportunities for people that just want to trade the markets. But longer term, I think we're going to see some returns to value, and I think particularly the mining and resources sector are going to offer great value, and we could well see a recovery simply because the amount of monetary stimulus going into the system around the world from countries around the world who are dealing with the COVID issues, funding furlough payments, funding sectors to keep the companies afloat. I think the net result is that money will be monetary stimulus will continue to be provided, which will ultimately devalue fiat currency. So commodities such as precious metals, which is, and of course that's why we've seen the gold price make the progress that we have. Mm-hmm. So I do believe that the raw commodities and the precious metals you'll see greater demand for those. You'll see them increase in value, and by virtue of that, we could see a shift. So the sectors that have been badly affected by COVID, the lack of growth from those areas will be offset by the a growth and possibly a rejuvenation in the junior mining sector over the next few years. But that's pure speculation on my part. But that's the strategy that's in the back of my mind when I approach investing at the moment.
Okay, yeah, it's diverse there, Alan, isn't it? Very diverse. You've got some safe stuff and the sort of more volatile but potentially bigger return stocks there as well.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, the funds are safe. The funds are consistent performers. So I'm happy to stick with those. And but again, when you get a sharp movement in the markets, there's always an opportunity to buy back in. And whilst you know you can look at oil and say, well, oil is we've already seen with BP. BP downgrading production, is set to downgrade production, invest into renewables. Shell's going the same way, but nonetheless, these are huge companies that will be supply and demand for many years to come. So I think they're still sound companies, and they have the resources and the resources at their disposal to be able to not necessarily pivot so much, but certainly develop into new areas of renewable energy and create new revenue streams that a couple of years ago simply didn't exist.
Didn't exist, exactly. And your exposure to the mining and exploration, is that something that's always been interesting to you, or is it more because of how you feel at the moment, as you said, with regards to what's going on in the economy?
It's always been of interest, Mark, but it's been of interest because I think certainly the larger mining companies like the Rios and Billitons and Anglos, we've seen a bounce back with those. But some of the junior mining stocks that own these assets, hitherto they've just sat on the assets because, of course, the price of the commodity didn't make it viable to actually put together a plan to get it out of the ground and to market. But that will change. As these commodities increase in value, projects that were hitherto uneconomical will be revisited. And as we've spoken about on previous podcasts, modern mining techniques, data mining, data sets, put those all together. You've got a commodity that's going up in value. And in some cases, it's going to cost you less to get the stuff out of the ground. I do believe there's going to be a resurgence in the junior mining sector in the next couple of years, but
it's something that's overdue, isn't it? And do you really think that we could be looking at that now?
I think we're seeing the start of that now. I think if you look at what's happening globally across the world, the raw commodities are going to increase in value. Simply because fiat currency is being, people won't get the returns on fiat currency that they were a few years ago, that always happens. When you have a currency that's being eroded and devalued for whatever reason, there will be a turn to, invariably people turn to gold first or gold and silver first of all, and certainly both of those are enjoying a renaissance at the moment.
There's definitely a lot more money sloshing about in the markets, Alan. I've even noticed that the level of placings in the last 4 or 5 weeks has started to accelerate, and that's a sign as well that the markets it's turned the corner. And there is a lot of new money in the market as well. I mean, I think that the furlough situation has brought the market's attention to a lot of sort of millennial investors. It's definitely the amount of followers that I've picked up from people that I've never, new Twitter handles that I've never came across before. So there's definitely new people in the space. But my only concern for them is that it's been pretty good for them. They've never had the kick in the balls that no doubt you've had, and I've certainly had several times as well, that you sometimes need to just remind you that this casino can take it all back just as quickly as it gives.
Oh, it can. Very much so. I think you're absolutely right, Kenny. I think a lot of, as you say, the millennial investors have maybe invested into a COVID stock. I mean, some of the performances of the COVID stocks has been incredible. You know, Novacyt, what was it, 15p last year, 30p in January, it's now trading £5, and Avacta and others, Synergen and other stocks. So a lot of these investors may well have had a punt and that they've made money. So the biggest danger of all is now thinking that you're a stock market expert because you've made money. No.
Yeah.
It can come back and bite you in the arse and take it all away. There's an old saying in the markets, no one ever went broke taking a profit. So always take your money out as soon as you can, and never invest more than you can afford to lose, because believe me, you can lose it.
Oh yeah, definitely. But all right, well, I think that's quite a nice statement to end on, Alan. Mark, have you got anything to?
No, thank you, Alan. It's been nice to have a casual chat and learn a bit about what your sort of personal life and your bikes, interesting, and where you've come from. Nice little chat. So yeah, that's a good note to finish on, I think.
Thank you, guys. It's been great to speak with you both too. So I'll go and crack a vice pair.
Okay.
Yeah, great.
Good stuff.
Thanks, Alan.
Cheers, Alan. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Fairbairn and Russell. Tune in next time.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.